Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. in Shelburne, Vermont. That is 9 p.m. in Dundalk, Ireland. 10 p.m. in Gothenburg, Sweden, and Kandel, Germany. And you'll know why I've singled out those four fine municipalities if you read my Monday column. And where do we get to? 10 o'clock in Germany? That means 11 o'clock in Cairo and Jerusalem, and midnight in Riyadh, and the wee small hours of Wednesday morning in India, breakfast in Australia, a rather more civilized hour for our listeners in New Zealand and the rest of the Pacific. And we are live all around the planet taking questions from Mark Stein Club members on the big picture things, the big picture things. I'm not here to talk about whether Oprah is going to pick Meryl Streep as her running mate. I don't care about that. We're going to look at the big pictures. And actually, just in reference to the demographic situation, which underpins everything, I do believe ultimately demography is destiny. The who is more important than the what, where, when, and why in that sense. And it has been an interesting start to the new year with that little ragtag bag of stories that I was rustling through in my Monday column. But also some other things. The Economist has now noticed that China has a huge problem with its distorted sex ratio. That's to say, it has far more boys than girls, because under its one-child policy instituted in the 70s, they aborted all the boys, aborted all the girls, or actually killed some of them, actually, too, after they'd been born, so that they've now got all these sons and there are no daughters for them to marry. And I wrote about this. This will ring a bell to you in 2006 in my book America Alone, because as I said in that book, unless they're planning on becoming the first gay superpower since Sparta, a huge surplus of young men is not a fine recipe for societal stability. And The Economist called my book, quote, alarmist. All the clever chaps at The Economist said it was, quote, alarmist. Now, 12 years later, the clever chaps at The Economist have caught up to the consequences of China's one-child policy. That's one example of how demography is destiny. Here, let's have another one from Ireland before we get to all the questions. This one was sent along to me by one of our readers in the old sod, and it is in fact the preliminary numbers from the 2016 Irish census, and the ones on religion are fascinating. And there's been absolutely no commentary on this in the press. The Muslim population between 2011 and 2016 of Ireland. Now, like, if you've never been across the sea to Ireland, you probably think whatever the hell is going on there, it's something to do with Protestants and Catholics. Forget that. That's so last century. The Muslim population of Ireland between 2011 and 2016 increased by, if you look at the graph, 28.9%. That it's increased by 30%, the Muslim population of Ireland. Now, when the actual précis of the big trends notes that the Catholic population is down from 84.2% to 78.3%, and there's been a corresponding rise in the number with no religion, which grew by 73.6%. And they're doing all this. They don't actually mention the fact that in 5 years, the Muslim population of Ireland grew by 30%. It's now exactly, or not quite exactly, just a little more than half the size of the Church of Ireland population, which is the main Protestant. It's the Anglican Church. It's the equivalent of the Church of England across the sea. And there now, the Muslim population is now half the size of the Protestant population, of the Church of Ireland population, the number two church in the country, the Anglican Church. and which admittedly declined since the establishment of the Irish Free State in 1922, as there was a little bit of population resettlement up in the north and what have you. But the idea that at present rates, they're on course to actually supplant the Church of Ireland as Ireland's number two church within a little more than half a decade is quite incredible. Incidentally, if there'd been a 30% increase in the population in of supporting the Church of Ireland in Ireland, the Irish would have thought that the old Protestant ascendancy and the English had come back and recolonised the country. But nobody talks about this. 30% increase in Ireland's Muslim population in the last 5 years. So we're going to talk about all these big picture subjects, and we will get to and we will get to try and get to as many of them as you can. Holly writes, Mark, what is your advice for a first or second year female college student who wants to study in Europe, specifically Norway? Are there any actions one can take to increase a person's safety in these countries, or is this another facet of life that we can only look back on with regret that it's not feasible any longer? Well, Holly, what's happening in Europe is no reason not to go there any more than when you're in Europe and you look at Ferguson burning on your TV news, that's a reason not to visit the United States. In any country, there are places where you can go and places where you can't go. You quickly learn when you go to continental countries that there are parts of those countries where it's inadvisable to go, especially after dark. Molenbeek, for example, just across the canal in from Brussels. So on one side of the canal, you've got touristy Brussels, sidewalk cafes and all the rest of it. And then over the canal bridge, you've got Molenbeek, which in the last few years has become almost exclusively Muslim. They've basically chased everybody out who isn't Muslim. It's where the Paris, the guy who pulled off those big Paris attacks, was living. Absolutely absurdly, living in the old town square in Molenbeek. Actually, his flat was actually across the street from the police station. But the Brussels police can't even find anybody when they're actually sitting across some tiny little pedestrianised square from the guy, and he's going out to have coffee and talk with all his mates every morning. So it's not a good idea to go to Molenbeek after dark. I went to Molenbeek after dark and I survived, and then I got set upon. In fact, when I crossed back over to Brussels. So things can happen to you anywhere. One of the great tragedies of what we're witnessing in Europe is that things can happen to you even when you're not looking for them, like the Japanese guy in Dundalk and the Australian guy in Gothenburg. The last thing, as I said in my column, paraphrasing Conan Doyle in The Tragedy of the Korosko, the last fate on earth a Japanese student or an Australian boyfriend would have predicted for themselves is that they'd meet their end at the hands of a fanatical Mohammedan, not in Libya or Yemen or Somalia or Waziristan, but in Ireland or Sweden. Nevertheless, those countries are not in a state of civil war, and you should certainly see them while you can, because it's only going to get worse. So thank you for that. Congratulations to Patty Villanova, who has just signed up for the Mark Stein Club today. So she's a brand new club member today. Congratulations to Patty. Patty says she lives in suburban New York. And yesterday she had her hair done by a young woman who was originally from Pakistan, who told me she had 9 children. As I spoke with this woman, I couldn't help thinking about my own daughters who are in their 40s and their friends, none of whom would dream of having so many children, even when they were younger. I've read all of your brilliant articles on immigration, migration. What, if anything, can we do to encourage our young people to be fruitful and multiply, that is, to have more children? That's interesting to me that she's living in New York, this Pakistani lady, and she has 9 children. In the United Kingdom, they found that in the early 70s, Pakistani Britons fertility rate had declined, so it was getting closer to, you know, a typical English, Scottish type fertility rate. And then what happened as the population, the Pakistani population of Britain, increased and it became more possible to live in a Pakistani type community in the United Kingdom, the birth rates went up again and got closer back to what they were in the old country, in Mirpur and other parts of Pakistan. And so this idea that birth rates decline to meet the norm is not the case. That's not the case with, for example, Tunisians in Europe actually have more children than Tunisians in Tunisia do. So to talk about, and you're right that it's absolutely extraordinary. You will meet Pakistani women. I assume this woman, just on the arithmetic, if she's had nine children, she's got to be at least 30. But as you know, Muslim women have more children and they start younger, much younger. So they're like on their third kid by the time they're 22 or 23. And a Western woman like your daughter and her friends, they like to have one yuppie designer kid at the age of 39. You can tell in the way we talk about only children. People used to feel sorry. I'm old enough to remember my mum and her friends, and they'd be talking about a pal of mine. I'd overhear them. They'd be talking about a pal of mine, and they'd say, "Oh, it's such a pity, he's an only child." It was regarded as a sort of unfortunate thing to be one child. And now it's become a kind of perfectly normal. Nobody talks about only children anymore. They think it's great, you know, somebody's 39, 40, 43, and they want to have one designer kid. One of the things we need to do is actually expand adulthood. As I've often said, in the old day, in my corner of New Hampshire, you were basically a kid till you were about 13. Then you were a grown-up. Then you died. That's it. They were the three stages of life. You were a kid till you were 13. Then you started work on the farm. And you work until you keeled over and died. And those two stages of life, kid, adult, that's all there was. And we've introduced two new phases. One is adolescence, which used to be just something, why must I be a teenager in love? Used to be just a teenage thing. Then came universal college education. Then came universal protracted college education, where you take 6 years to do a bachelor's degree, and then you've got so much debt that the best way of deferring that debt is to take some master's degree in some pointless subject. So we've eaten up most of the 20s. We've taken adolescence and extended it from "Why must I be a teenager in love?" All the way to what used to be the start of early middle age at 30. And then at the other end, we've got this period called retirement, which means that particularly in Europe, where they retire, you know, whatever it is in France, 57, 53, 48, who knows what it's down to. That again has shrunk and compressed adulthood. And what we need to do is to make family formation affordable and practical earlier. And it's quite ridiculous to me. When you listen to mainstream politicians, either have no idea of the hell that is about to engulf us, or they are willing it on. But when you listen to people say, no, we need to have everybody go to college, what the hell for? Then college, I mean, school is a waste of time as it is at the moment. I'm astonished at how little my own kids learn in high school, how undemanding it is compared to what I had to do. If everybody goes to college, then a bachelor degree will effectively become the equivalent of middle school. People will just be killing time. And life is time, and time is life. That's all it is. Life is time, time is life. It's very easy to remember it. Time Life, the Time Life Corporation, whatever they are now. They're part of Time Warner or something. But Time Life, that's it. Life is time, and time is life. So if you waste your time, you waste your life. And so how you use the time is critically important. And we have to. Nobody says you should have 9 kids. But actually, recalibrating things so that affordable family formation can come earlier and not be deferred until you have your first child in the mid-30s. That's the biggest change we could make. Chris Hall writes, is the only hope for Western civilization to wall itself off in a Zardoz-like state? If so, and if we don't all wind up being apathetics or renegades, will Vortex North America wind up being populated by Mormons and Amish? Will Vortex Europe turn out to be a struggle between Poles and Magyars? Writes Chris from Milan, Michigan. And he chides me. He says it's pronounced Milan because he thinks I'm an effete foreign Nancy boy who's going to say Milan, Michigan. No, I'm not. There's a Milan, New Hampshire just down the road from me here. So it is Milan, Michigan, and he's talking about Western civilization walling itself off. I've changed my view on that. Because, as I always say, I'm a 19th century imperialist, 100 years past my sell-by date. So after 9/11, I thought we could moderate Islam in the way that it was moderated before. It has been moderated in recent times by the Soviet Union in Central Asia, by Tito in the Balkans, by the dictatorship, the Sukarno dictatorship in Indonesia, and those aren't particularly appealing examples to Americans. It's also been moderated, was successfully moderated by the British Raj in the Indian subcontinent, and by actually a very small number of English civil servants in Sudan. That's what I thought we would do. I thought we would actually seriously push back in 2002 against all the walking around money that the Iranians and the Saudis dumped in the Balkans and Central Asia and Indonesia and elsewhere to radicalize relatively moderate Muslim populations. And my view was that we should try and get back to those kind of syncretic mom and pop Islams that you found in Central Asia. I was there whenever it was back in the 90s. And it was interesting to me. They drank alcohol. It was a pretty disgusting alcohol. But it's nice, actually. You'd be surprised how convivial these chaps can be once they've got a little bit of booze warming up the old stomach, and I would have liked us to apply some serious thought to getting back to that syncretic mom and pop Islam that they had in the Balkans and in Central Asia. And nobody, and I had a mild bit of influence over important people at that time, and I would mention it if I happened to be in a room with a prime minister or a president. They'd all be very interested, and then they'd get out their war maps and start talking about, you know, a drone taking out some guy at a wedding party in who gives a stan, and. And that was the beginning and end of their interest in it, really, the military struggle in Afghanistan. And so after 15 years, you're forced to conclude that nobody is really interested in nobody running the Western world, Theresa May, Monsieur Macron, Frau Merkel, nobody has Mr. Turnbull down in Oz. Nobody has has sufficient cultural confidence to get into the kind of civilizational cultural pressure game. So the best we can hope for, I think, is to wall ourselves off. And I don't know whether that means America's going to be turning Mormon. And everybody in Europe is going to be a Polish plumber I do know that if we don't manage to wall ourselves off, then I think I said in short, I noticed somewhere the Chinese were importing people. They had some shortage of workers and were importing Africans. And I said, this is the way the world's going to be. The southern hemisphere is moving north. So North America, the United States will become Hispanic, Europe will become Muslim, and in a slightly more complex journey, China will become African. So the walling off part is I think doable, and when people say, "Oh, we need to do this and we need to do that," and you look at the people who are running, the people who are politically viable in Europe and North America. Trump is as far as you can go and get elected in a free Western society, and once you've elected Trump, the question is whether the deep state and the permanent bureaucracy are going to actually let him do anything. And the jury, yes, he got Gorsuch on the Supreme Court and he got the tax bill and he got this and he got that. But on the big question, the existential question, and in fact, the platform on which he ran, the border wall and all the rest, the jury is still out on whether the deep state and the judges and the permanent bureaucracy are going to actually let him do that stuff. So it's all very well to talk about we need to do this and we need to do that and we need to do all. The question is what it actually is doable. And it seems to me that actually expanding the conversation on an end to mass immigration, mass unskilled immigration, which no Western nation needs. They only do it as a form of masochism. That's all. It's as a form of societal self-loathing. That's the only reason they do it. And it seems to me that if you keep expanding, and they don't want us even to talk about this, which is why in Germany, for example, they introduced this new law on New Year's Day, and the first person to fall afoul of it and have her Twitter account cut off was the deputy leader, or whatever she is, of Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, the so-called far-right party. But in fact, people like that are incredibly important, because the one thing you can get popular support for, I believe, is an end to mass immigration, not just an end to chain migration, to diversity lotteries, to all the other, to refugees gaming the system, but a recognition that no advanced society in the year 2018 needs mass unskilled immigration. And in that sense, it is I think it's doable. I think it's you can persuade people of it, and for me that is the position to take. Alex Balder writes: there's a worldwide assault on freedom of expression, except in the USA, where freedom of expression is supposedly protected by the Second Amendment. Yeah, that's a common line that the Second Amendment undergirds the rights of the First Amendment. All over the Western world, the thought police use state organs and courts to muzzle expressions that they do not like and persecute people that try to express their dissenting opinions. In many respects, the situation is as bad as it was in Europe during the Nazi occupation and in Eastern Europe under the boot of communism. Here in the US, the majority of the print and broadcast media are controlled by the left, and they do whatever they can to shout down and deny non-leftist media the space to report the news that they try to hide. I wonder, there are a number of internet-based free voice outlets, but all of them are struggling to get their message out due to financial constraints. I wonder if it would be possible to find a common ground to unite them and get the message out more economically. I think about this a lot, Alex. I don't actually like. What do they call Facebook and Twitter and YouTube? And I don't really like it. I don't really like being there. But you have to be there because right now they're monopolies. They should actually be broken up by the Justice Department. I don't understand, as I've said, why if Standard Oil a little over a century ago, 1908 or whatever it was, if that was big enough to be broken up, why Facebook, and in particular, which is bigger, or Google, which are bigger than effectively in what they control, are bigger than any companies have ever been, ever. And they don't just, and they're controlling the most vital product of all, which is information. I think it is time that both the antitrust division in the US and whatever the equivalent is in the European Union broke them up, broke both of them up. But we have to concede that the right actually wastes its money. I don't know why they do this. I think this is one of the problems with what they call Conservative Inc., INC, Conservatism Incorporated in the United States, that the people who fund it don't often think about where the bang for the buck might be biggest. And I have a lot of respect for the Koch brothers and the Mercers and all these people. They're far wealthier than I'll ever be. But it seems to me that, you know, we don't actually need another conservative news aggregation site. We don't need another eaglepatriot.com or whatever. That it would actually make more sense, particularly given that Twitter in particular is now explicitly at war with conservatives. YouTube, I can't be bothered with YouTube, with the so-called monetization on YouTube, because YouTube uses monetization as a ripoff. You know, my old friend Dennis Prager, he puts his videos on there. They're blocked. They're suddenly deemed controversial, so they're not eligible for advertising revenue. So you could be as utterly left-wing as you want on YouTube, and you'll be getting all these dollars from advertising, because apparently, you know, people who make diapers or whatever don't mind advertising on left-wing loony sites. But YouTube demonetize at the stroke of the hat people like Dennis Prager, so you can't actually make any, no matter how many hits you can have a left-wing guy who's got a million hits and a right-wing guy who's got a million hits, and the left-wing guy's getting advertising revenue and the right-wing guy is being has been deemed to be too controversial for monetization by YouTube. So the lesson there is, the bigger YouTube gets, the bigger Google gets, the bigger Facebook gets, the bigger the advantage the left will get. And in the end, so starting up, oh, you know, this is your one-stop shop for conservative news, patrioteagle.com. It's not actually about the content. It's about the money. It's about the money. And the right is stupid on this. The right is completely stupid on this. $1 billion spent on Mitt Romney's campaign, you might as well have tossed it out into the Potomac and washed it float out to sea. You'd be better off. Why not buy the New York Times? You don't like the influence of the New York Times? Buy it. Why is it some Mexican guy who got hold of it? Why not buy a movie studio? Why not actually use your dollars in an effective way? And that's what it is. That's what it is. In the end, the big, as we've just seen, I just mentioned that just a couple of minutes ago. First day of a new law in the new year in Germany, and all through the build-up to January the 1st, we say, no, this isn't a censorship law. This isn't an anti-free speech law. This is what it is the government, Angela Merkel is particularly repulsive on this, allying themselves with the social media monopolies, Facebook and Twitter, to squeeze the parameters of acceptable public discourse. And that's not going to end anywhere good. So nuts to Ankara, nuts to Twitter, and the best way to ensure you're not clobbered by that is not to be dependent on Twitter. George Pereira writes, in Sweden, what happens when Islam takes complete political control? Does absolute vodka disappear? What about the capable Swedish military establishment? Does it become a lot easier for the Pakistani government to order aircraft from Islamic Sweden than from Russia or China or America? Does the Swedish Navy sail for the Mediterranean and blockade Israel? Does Sweden become the arsenal of Allah? What does a mostly Islamic Britain do? By that, I mean, whose side do they take? Well, our friend Laura Rosen-Cohen had the best line on this. I showed a bunch of so-called, quote, Swedes, unquote, of a particular persuasion dancing up and down in the street, I think torching some flags or whatnot. I said it. I put the jokey caption on saying it's the ABBA revival concert in Malmo or whatever it was. And Laura appended to that, ABBA who Akbar. That's what it should be in Sweden. ABBA who Akbar. Well, yeah, the vodka goes. It's not clear to me whether IKEA will go too, because you have to assemble that furniture yourself. And to be honest, given the low level of skills of many of these refugees, I'm not sure how big a market there'll be for self-assembly furniture in the Sweden of the future. People have come to think somehow of countries as just like zip codes. You know, they're not at all. I mean, Poland was a state on wheels, as it was between Germany and Russia. And if you look at Poland on the map, it's gone back and forth, east and west, all back and forth through history. But the reason for its movement is that Poland is the place where Poles are. Sweden is the place where Swedes are. And so when, as is predicted by mid-century, Swedes become ethnic Swedes become a minority in their own country, what is that zip code on the map? What is it? It's not Sweden anymore. People think, again, to quote me, because we've been round the block on all this, to quote me, in 2006 in America alone, people think it's like David Merrick's famously opportunist cast change with Hello Dolly, after it had Carol Channing and Mary Martin and Ginger Rogers and all these other. And then he'd run out of white middle-aged ladies to put in the show, and he signed Pearl Bailey, who's black, and he decided to do an all-black version of Hello, Dolly. So it's like the same songs, the same plot, the same lines of dialogue, the same dancing, just with a black cast instead of a white cast. And people think that is how it will be with Sweden, that you will go to Sweden and somehow it will still be Swedish, even though the biggest religion in the country is Islam. That somehow Germany will still be German, even though the most powerful demographic voting bloc will be Turkish Muslims. It won't be like that. And it won't just be at the periphery that things change. For example, having a beer garden in a German city isn't going to be a good business to be in within the next 5 to 10 years. Likewise, having the pub in an English village isn't going to be a big... And you can already see all that in the East End of London. I was walking down whatever it is, either the Commercial Road or the Old Kent Road in the East End of London a couple of years ago. And I hadn't been there in years. And I was noting, like, the pubs that had closed and things. And I suddenly had a yen, and I suppose it was because I was watching the death of Cockney London. I suddenly had a yen for fish and chips. I hate fish and chips. There's a place in Toronto I like for fish and chips, but fish and chips is a disaster in the United States. So I don't go one decade to the next, but I had a sudden yen for fish and chips. And the last time I'd walked down there, there'd been like a fish and chip place every block or two. I walked miles and miles down that road, and then I gave up, didn't bother with it. But that's on the surface. You see all that already. That's on the surface. What's really important here is the fundamental rights that disappear. Not just that the pub closes, but that freedom of speech closes down too. Intellectual inquiry closes down. Music closes down. Representative art closes down. I mean, these aren't small things. The idea that it's somehow just, you know, Sweden with Muslims is still Sweden is completely preposterous. In the international sense, which George talks about, it's also the case that, which we will see now, that when you have, with the big five at the UN Security Council, when you have the United Kingdom, France, Russia, countries in which Islam is a serious domestic consideration, the idea that the United States will be finding many friends for its policies there, I think, is also kind of slightly ridiculous. Let's go to Kate. How can the influence of existing law-abiding Islamic communities be moderated before they have a more direct impact? What, if any, practical approaches and policies could be used to end one-way multiculturalism and Islamic affirmative action? The smiley face cooperative jihad the West is so keen to facilitate, jobs for refugee hairdressers, etc., is far more insidious and just as problematic. And that's actually correct there, Kate, that it is the multicultural left in Western countries, which either through stupidity or malevolence makes common cause with the worst aspects of Islam, is the real problem. There are practical organizations. A couple of years ago, I met a guy from an organization called Mosque Busters, and he meant what he said, that they stop mosques being built in your area. They're very expert at finding, at if you like, making a case against them in zoning terms, which is important. Because it is in these radical mosques where the group solidarity, as it were, is cemented, and everyone is surprised by these things after the fact. No matter how many radical imams, I mean, just to put it in civilizational terms, it's imams. You hear all the time about radical imams. Have you ever heard anyone ever talking about a radical vicar? Have you ever heard anyone find some Anglican vicar or from the Church of Ireland we were talking about earlier who starts foaming about this stuff? No. So having a mosque open in your town is not the same as having a congregational church open in your town. And that's why they should be resisted on that basis too. The other point is, which you dwell on, is one-way multiculturalism. And I think that's when the left defend Islam importation, the importation of Islam into the West. You should use the term one-way multiculturalism, which is a term Christopher Hitchens, I believe, came up with when he was discussing my book. And it's an excellent term. Because you can't have a Bible in Saudi Arabia. It's illegal to have a Bible in Saudi Arabia. So when we let Saudis come into North America and Europe, on what basis do we defer to them on the Quran? What they're telling us, when you look at that, you can't be a Christian in Saudi Arabia. You can't be a Jew in Saudi Arabia. You've got these ridiculous, actually, signs on the highway that tell Christians to take the last exit before Mecca and Medina. Now, what they're telling you is that in their own lands, they don't wish to live with the other. So to import a significant population that does not wish to live with the other is to store up a heap of trouble, because they're telling you that when they're strong enough, they'll be instituting one-way multiculturalism here too. And that's true if you look at the Manchester bombing. That guy, the guy who did that Ariana Grande bombing, he came from a part of Manchester that used to be English, and then it became multicultural, so you had a bit of this and a bit of that. And then once the bit of that, which is Islam, got sufficient in numbers, they chased out the bit of this. And so it is unicultural now. If you walk through large swathes of the East End, that has become unicultural. So you have to resist it at the local level. You have to object to it. I was happy to do this with a couple of Mark Stein Club members who were having someone from CARE come to talk to their library and come to talk to their church. They had some wishy-washy church that had invited along in some interfaithy thing a CARE guy, and the library had invited along a CARE guy. I actually helped them point out what CARE has done. It's an unindicted co-conspirator in terrorism funding. Put these guys on the defensive and demand that if libraries and churches and schools are going to invite these people in, that the truth about them be known. You have to, and you're fighting against the worst local press in the world, the most awful, boring newspapers in the English speaking world. Are in the United States particularly. I mean, they're bad in Canada, and they're bad at, you know. But the point about them is there's a reflex to present these stories as some sappy feel good thing, and you got to get on the journalist case, and you got to take up the comment section, and you got to tell the truth about these people. Doesn't mean you have to be racist. Doesn't mean you have to be this or that aphobic. But it means, for example, that if it's a CARE guy, CARE should not be respectable. CARE are unindicted co-conspirators in a terrorism funding plot. There's like one degree of separation between them and all the worst guys on the planet. They're not respectable, and they should not be allowed to be pass themselves off as respectable. Rich says, thanks for hosting another Q&A. It's my favourite part of the Mark Stein Club. And he has a couple of questions. He says, what can the average person do to help change the course of immigration policy to move from a mostly useful idiot multicultural monolith to a more reasonable system in practice? Well, Rich, what the first thing to do is to talk about it. I mean, we have a situation where the default position is assumed to be the left-wing position. And that's not true, actually. If you actually put straightforward, honest questions to the American people, it's about 80% who don't want the present immigration policy, who want fewer immigrants. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about illegal immigrants, legal immigrants, they want less of them. And so the thing to do is to talk about that. Tell people so that people don't feel, the 80% doesn't feel somehow as it does when it listens to bleating ninnies on American TV going on about, quote, a nation of immigrants, unquote, that they're in some kind of minority. The second thing is not to actually concede on a lot of these ridiculous cliches about a nation of immigrants. And the third thing is not to sentimentalize it, but to actually look at it in hard-headed terms. What's interesting is that people have a reflex. It's almost automatic that certain subjects, they rise in your gullet, and the reflex lever clicks in and shuts the thought down before you express it. So the first thing you can do is express the thought, and don't defer to the cliches. When there's some twit on TV bleating about immigration, where nation of immigrants are hardworking immigrants, there's 7 billion people on the planet. Maybe they're all hardworking, but it doesn't mean they should all go and live in America, even though America's quite a big country. And it certainly doesn't mean they should all go and live in Ireland or Denmark, which are quite small countries. So talk about it. Talk about it realistically. He says, have you ever worked with, or do you have any comment on Numbers USA? The only thing I know for Numbers USA which I find interesting, are their gradings of legislators. And I think I have the feeling I mentioned this somewhere, maybe on television or something in the last couple of weeks. But if you look at them, you'll find the Democrats are all basically F minus on immigration. So you think, OK, well, it's a two-party system. What have the other party got to say? And if you look at Republicans, they're actually sort of D minus, D, D plus. If you know, they're not actually, that's how they average. There's a lot of totally disastrous congressmen and senators on the immigration issue. So that's the power of the lobby groups. That's the power of the people who want cheap labor, the Chamber of Commerce people. They're the people who are killing your country and are ensuring that your kids and grandkids will have a stinker of a future. So you got to. And the great thing Donald Trump did was to render the donor class that buys up the Republican Party irrelevant. And because he didn't need donors, he was able to talk honestly about immigration. So the best thing you can do, again, the best thing you can do for that is actually make plain to your legislators that voters are more important than donors. And actually there are rewards for them if they actually take the position that accords with their base. And then I'll save Rich's other question. That's a slightly different question. I'll come to that in another thing. I'll probably deal with that in Mark's mailbox, I think. It's a slightly different angle. Hey, Mark, says Benjamin Carr, how bad will the demographic problems be that are arising out of China's disastrous one-child policy in the upcoming decades? And what will the consequences be? I touched on this at the beginning of the show because The Economist, after damning me as, quote, alarmist in 2006, has taken 12 years to catch up to me. They have the most distorted sex imbalance on Earth. Because they've and normally sex imbalances are caused by wars. Historically, even the Great War, for example, there were a lot of English women of that generation who became spinsters simply because most of the eligible, not most, but a big chunk of the eligible young men had been killed on the Western Front and there were no men for them to marry. That's what causes, very unusual to have a sex imbalance that's the other way round, where you have vast surpluses of men for whom there are no women. And as I always say, young men who can't get any action is not a recipe for social stability, as we have seen in Europe, where all these young Muslim men came in and, surprise, surprise, they have a massive uptick in crime. One of the statistics that is actually common to all cultures across the planet is that in any society, crime is caused by young men in their late teens, early 20s. Wherever you are, it doesn't matter whether you're in the jungles of New Guinea or you're in suburban Los Angeles. They're the people committing the crime. So China has a problem. And Benjamin Carr asks, does it mean more sex slaves from North Korea, aggressive territorial expansion? And he says, I seem to imply that China will just sit around like a fat panda willing to trade with anyone who play by its rules. I don't think so that at all. In America alone, by the way, I suggested they might well just seize the Russian East, which is full of resources, and they'll pick up a few rather wrinkly old babushkas that some of the young lads might like too. But I think you will actually see massive... I think one of the things that is coming to our world is actually a massive increase in sex slavery. And in a sense, what happened in Rotherham and what has happened in other parts of Europe, if you have a culture, you can't have different cultures overlaid like different area codes. So, for example, if you are in the Middle East and you're raised in a world where all the women are covered and you're married to your cousin and you don't actually get to see what she's like out of her burqa until the wedding night and then you're more or less stuck with her or whatever, That's fine. That's one. That's a unicultural world, and you live in it. If you live in a Muslim culture in Northern England, and all your sister and your cousins are all covered from head to toe, but they're these like English slatterns all over the street with little halter tops and pierced belly buttons, and skirts that barely descend to the tops of their legs. It's asking an awful lot for you to live according to the constraints of your culture when there's this other one side by side. And I think what happened in Rotherham, in a sense, had a kind of vile logic to it, that the powerful Muslim men in that town simply took the paki, the white slags, as the police called them, and use them as their sex slaves. And I think there's going to be a huge market for sex slavery in the years to come. And I think China in particular will at some point have to actually come up with some means of redressing that situation, if necessary, by essentially importing a pool of available women. Philip writes from England, how is it possible to have a public conversation about these big picture issues when discussion of Islam has been pretty much criminalized in many countries as hate speech? How can citizens express their fears and demands of the government when all the forces and resources of the state are being used as Sharia enforcement squads? If we can't even talk about this, how can we change anything? Well, that's why it is important to talk about it. It's important to exercise your right to talk about it. It's important, I think, and everyone has their points on the spectrum here. I actually think, by the way, you need intemperate, nutty people because in a certain sense, they're the outlier. They're the mechanical hair. And you have to have someone get going so other people, you know, people follow them. At the same time, Geert Wilders and other founders of new populist nationalist parties in Europe have said to me over the years, as they've been talking about their parties, that they understand that the first thing that happens when you start a new party is you have to be prepared to be a party of only one or two or three or four people for a little while, because almost immediately the first people who want to join the new party are all the skinheads and racists, and then the press damn you as racist and skinhead and fascist, and you never get anywhere. And actually managing that, how you talk about it, I believe, is critically important. It's becoming less important, mainly because no matter how moderately you talk about it, the powers that be will still shut you down. One of the good things that my friend Douglas Murray did was get the BBC to issue an apology to him, because essentially they'd portrayed him as a hater. He's in fact the soul of moderation. He's an urbane, civilized man who asserts the right to talk about what is happening before our eyes. And the more they attempt to repress people like Douglas Murray, the more they will actually expand the appeal of the most extreme voices, because why the hell not? What do you got to lose? They're going to come for you anyway. You might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb, as they say. The only way you can do it, they can't. The thing about this, and this is critical, Philip, is you have to say it. There will be people who will, when you are, if something goes wrong and you're hauled up, there will be people and there will be groups who support you. I've gone hither and yon speaking up for people who find themselves in these situations. But what is absolutely critical is to speak up and to share the risk. That's Ayaan Hirsi Ali's words. You know, in the end, the Charlie Hebdo guys died alone, because all the stupid people who wanted to wear brooches and say "Je suis Charlie" after they were lying in a pool of blood on the floor had never done a bloody thing for them when it counted. Charlie Hebdo died because the guys at Charlie Hebdo died because they were the only people willing to publish, republish those Mohammed cartoons. And we need to share the risk. There just aren't enough people. And you see it in England particularly. Shame on England, the crucible of liberty in the modern world. And you look at what they, the fact they can all gang up and clobber Katie Hopkins because there's only one Katie Hopkins. If there were 1,000 Katie Hopkins, it wouldn't matter. They wouldn't be able to all take the cudgels to her and beat her to a pulp because there'd be 999 other people they'd have to take a cudgel to and beat to a pulp. And the most important thing is to assert the right to speak up and to keep speaking up. And to deny that the state has any right to shut you up. And you see it. And I tell you another thing to do in your country, Philip. Not actually in your country, but just north of Hadrian's Wall, because Police Scotland are particularly stupid about this. And so are the police service of Northern Ireland. So your fellow citizens of the United Kingdom. The British police as a whole do all this hate crime. The British police will investigate anything except crime. That's what they do now. So if you say something on Twitter, Her Majesty's Constabulary will come after you. And even if nobody's saying anything on Twitter, they issue these shameful tweets saying, don't step out of line because we're watching you. And you should. And what I love about this is I always retweet this bozo stuff from Police Scotland and these other idiotic constabularies in the United Kingdom. And then a bunch of people pile on and say to Police Scotland, no, you do not have the right. I don't care if you're watching me. Watch this. And then they will make an impolitic gesture. Kathy Shadle's great line is that you are too stupid to tell me what to think. And if you think that's a little overheated, read the tweets of Police Scotland. Police Scotland are too stupid to tell anybody what to think. And so every time Police Scotland, which is some mumbo-jumbo name, they've given, they combined a bunch of whatever it was, old constabularies, the Aberdeenshire Constabulary or whatever the hell it was, into this stupid Police Scotland. They took all the police services of Scotland and merged them into one and then managed to identify the 9 biggest morons in the country and put them in charge of it. Policemen, do not police your thoughts and do not police your words. And any time some twerp constable or twerp PR representative of Police Scotland or any of these other places tries to tell you what to think, you tell them to take a hike. I love the pylons these guys get. And remember that Kathy Shadle line too. You're too stupid to tell me what to think. And when you're sitting in the pub or you're sitting around in your own home and friends start tentatively admitting they agree with you on this and agree with that, you tell them. It's important to speak it up. It's like whatever it is, the new moon. Just give me 10 who are stout-hearted men and I'll soon give you 10,000 more. Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald. That's how it starts. They're walking through the woods in black and white and there's just him. And then Pierre and Louis and a couple of others join in. The pen is only more powerful than the sword if people are prepared to pick up the pen. And right now, from Facebook to Police Scotland to Twitter, people are trying to actually deny you the ink to use the pen. They're trying to take away your paper. It's actually critical. Not to let yourself be told by numbskull bureaucrats what to think. Last question comes from Mike. Mike says, Mark, add New Zealand to the childless leader column. I've noted this before, how Europe, which is in a demographic death spiral, is led by childless leaders. Monsieur Macron, I think, is the stepdad to his old high school drama teacher who's, I'm not sure, her kids, I think, are they older than him? I don't know. Anyway, I don't think he's much of a father figure to them, but Frau Merkel, the gay guy with a Hindu dad, from Bombay who's mysteriously wound up as Taoiseach of Ireland. I would I would love to know what De Valera made of that. What was it, Yeats's line about a terrible beauty is born? I think when he... There's your terrible beauty. They had the revolution and the gay Hindus were the beneficiary of it. But it is a remarkable thing that the political class exemplify the biggest problem in the Western world, in Europe, in Ireland, and now in New Zealand, the childless leaders. And it is a bizarre and unsettling phenomenon, because to come back to where we came in demography is destiny. And the great line from America Alone, if I do say so myself, and I do, because The Economist certainly isn't going to say it about me, they just take 12 years to catch up with me. My great line from America Alone, the future belongs to those who show up for it. And in that sense, demography is always destiny. Who is there? Knock, knock, who's there? And you know who is knocking on the doors of the Western world at the moment. That is it for another Clubland Q&A. If you would like to ask a question on our next Clubland Q&A, all you need to do is be a member of the Mark Stein Club. We don't just charge you a membership fee to ask questions in our Clubland Q&A. We've got lots of other great stuff that comes with club membership, including a new tale for our time. If you've been shivering, if you're frozen in a snowbank right this moment in northeastern part of North America, if you are actually lying dead from hypothermia in a mountain notch in northern New England, we will have a tale for your time, for our time, to warm you up. Starting this Friday. That all comes with membership in the Mark Stein Club. And we will pick up some of the questions we didn't get to in a special video edition of Mark's Mailbox later this week. But that is it for today's Clubland Q&A. The old clock on the wall, as the disc jockeys used to say. The old clock on the wall. There isn't an old clock on the wall here. I don't know what I'm talking about. But that's the magic of radio. It's the power of imagination. You think I've got a grandfather clock just propped against the wall. And it says 5 p.m. Eastern Time in North America, 10 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Meantime, we're out of here. See you next time.